This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Alert Radio for people who want to change the world. I'm Jeff Hughes.
I'm Chris Elby.
I'll be speaking this week with John Ryan on the unlikely idea of a coalition between the Liberals, NDP, and the Greens to challenge Stephen Harper's dominance.
And I'm going to be chatting with Aditya Ganapathiraju, who is a senior student at the University of Washington in Seattle, who's going to be talking to us about the unfortunate disaster taking place right now in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Well, there's a conference of the Conservatives in Winnipeg, but also another conference, and you'll be speaking to someone on First Nations organizing, Chrissy.
Yeah, Clayton Thomas Mueller, co-convener of the Defenders of the Land gathering at the Indian Métis Friendship Center right here in the north end of Winnipeg.
We'll also have headlines and Around the Left in 7 days.
And André Clément with Music is the Weapon. And now for the alert headlines for the week of November the 13th, 2008.
Remembrance Day 2008 may well be remembered for the grim reports from the economic front. General Motors said on Monday that it would lay off 5,500 workers at North American plants. Consumer electronics retailer Circuit City Stores filed for U.S. bankruptcy protection on Monday. Nortel Networks booked one of the biggest quarterly losses in its history and will lay off another 1,300 employees. U.S. aluminum giant Alcoa has slashed capacity worldwide. DHL Express Overnight Delivery Unit is laying off 15,000 workers and closing most of its U.S. outlets.
A new Environics survey suggests that 56% of Canadians disagree with the federal government's decision to send back to the United States American Army deserters who fled to Canada to avoid having to fight in Iraq. Only 38% support the Conservative government. By a spread of 48-30%, Canadians also oppose the federal government's decision to let Canadian Omar Khadr be tried in a U.S. military court in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba.
A campaign to defend free speech by the Seriously Free Speech Committee has pushed media giant CanWest to drop its legal suit against Mordecai Breenberg over a parody of the Vancouver Sun. Breenberg is a retired academic and this year's winner of the YMCA International Peace Award. The campaign will, however, continue until CanWest also abandons legal action against Gordon Murray and Carol Mozewicz, who produced the parody in June 2007 that satirizes CanWest's well-known anti-Palestinian and pro-Israel bias. The committee organized an international effort and garnered support from personalities like Noam Chomsky, Naomi Klein, and MP Libby Davis.
The Vancouver City Council secretly authorized staff to advance as much as $100 million to the developer of the 2010 Olympics Athletes Village to keep the project afloat. However, prior to the 2003 Olympic plebiscite, Vancouver taxpayers were assured that any Olympic cost overruns would be covered by the provincial government. Estelle Lowe, Vancouver City Council's chief financial officer, has resigned, reportedly over concerns regarding this development. Because real estate values have plunged 10% in the past 6 months and some banks are forecasting another 18-20% drop in the next 2 years, this deal could lead to a downgrading of Vancouver's bond ratings.
On November 23rd, Venezuelans will go to the polls to elect governors, mayors, as well as state legislators and district committee councillors, a total of 603 positions. At stake will be the future direction of an economic, social, and political revolution led by President Hugo Chavez, which, since 2006, has unequivocally declared it will leave capitalism behind and build 21st century socialism. Opinion polls done in October by opposition groups, as well as those sympathetic to the government, predict a new and clear electoral victory for the revolution. Last December, a progressive constitutional reform proposal was narrowly defeated in a tainted plebiscite.
The American Civil Liberties Union launched a new campaign calling on President-elect Barack Obama to close the Guantanamo Bay prison and end the military commissions on day one of his presidency. The ACLU is reminding Obama of his campaign pledge to close Guantanamo, reject the Military Commissions Act, and adhere to the Geneva Conventions. It also wants Obama to issue executive orders banning the use of torture and abuse and ending the practice of extraordinary rendition. On November 13th, the ACLU will hold a nationwide telephone town hall to discuss the state of civil liberties transitioning from the Bush administration to the Obama administration.
The U.S. Federal Reserve is refusing to identify the recipients of almost $2 trillion of emergency loans from American taxpayers, or the troubled assets the central bank is accepting as collateral. Americans have no idea where their money is going or what securities the bank are pledging in return. Moreover, it is not clear how the Federal Reserve evaluates collateral. Banks oppose any release of information because it might signal weakness and spur short selling or a run by depositors, according to a senior spokesperson for the industry. Bloomberg News has requested details of the Fed lending under the U.S. Freedom of Information Act and has filed a federal lawsuit seeking to force disclosure.
President-elect Barack Obama's choice for his transition team has raised concerns among some of his more liberal supporters. His first high-profile appointment, that of his chief of staff, went to Rahm Emanuel, who has been a consistent and vocal pro-Israel hardliner, sometimes more so than President Bush. Robert Rubin was chairman of Citigroup Inc.'s executive committee when the bank pushed bogus analyst research and helped Enron cook its books. Almost half the people on Obama's economic advisory board have held positions at companies that, to one degree or another, either fried their financial statements, helped send the world into an economic tailspin, or both. Also in the transition team is Sonal Shah, an American supporter and fundraiser for right-wing Hindu-centric political parties in India.
The newly elected president of the Maldives, Mohamed Nasheed, says he wants to buy a new homeland for his people. He says that the gradual rise in sea levels caused by global warming means the Maldives islanders may eventually be forced to resettle elsewhere. The Maldives is the lowest nation in the world. Its highest land is little more than 2 meters above sea level. The United Nations estimates that sea levels may rise globally by nearly 60 centimeters this century. The white sandy beaches of the Maldives are a major tourist attraction, bringing in billions of dollars every year.
And that was the Alert Headlines for the week of November the 13th, 2008.
And now, Around the Left in 7 Days.
For more information on any of the events listed in Around the Left in 7 Days, go to CanadianDimension.com and click on Around the Left in 7 Days.
Students Against Israeli Apartheid at the University of Toronto holds a public forum on Israel's rebranding efforts on Thursday, November the 13th at 7 p.m. Apartheid by any other name, marketing the Israel brand in Toronto, is part of the 6th International Week Against the Apartheid Wall.
The Majority Agenda Coalition holds a rally at the National Convention of the Conservative Party of Canada starting at noon on Saturday, November 15th at the Winnipeg Convention Centre. The coalition represents the majority of Canadians, those that did not vote for Stephen Harper's Conservatives during the recent federal election.
Free public forum on British Columbia's water resources on Wednesday, November the 19th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Britannia Centre in Vancouver. Speakers include Tom Rankin of Save Our Rivers Society, Gwen Barley of the Western Wilderness Committee, and Betty Krawczyk. The forum examines the loss of control of valuable water and energy resources to private and foreign interests.
The Organizing for Justice Conference runs from Thursday, November 20th to Saturday, November 22nd at the Ottawa Public Library. The conference is a place for people who are fed up with the traditional politics to work on skills and tools that will help in efforts to enact change. Community organizers, activists, and people who are not yet involved but would like are all welcome.
And that's Around the Left in 7 Days.
For more information on any of the events listed in Around the Left in 7 Days, go to CanadianDimension.com and click on Around the Left in 7 Days.
And we're now joined by Clayton Thomas Mueller, who is a co-convener with a particular gathering called Defenders of the Land, and how he's joining us today in Winnipeg, but he's actually from Matthias Colomb Cree Nation. So first off, let's discuss what the Defenders of the Land Gathering is all about for those listeners out there who are not familiar.
Well, the gathering was convened for a few different reasons. I think first and foremost, at this particular point in time that we are currently in, there is an unprecedented targeting of First Nations communities, of Indigenous communities here in Canada, by both the federal and provincial government in partnership with unsustainable industry to develop our land and resources at a time when there are still unprecedented amounts of unresolved Indian land claims. There is still unresolved issues around the federal government of Canada's failure to recognize the adopted UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And in that context, you know, there is an outcry from grassroots Indigenous peoples across this country to try and call for accountability. I think that one of the primary reasons that, you know, we have pulled together this gathering where we have representation, both elected and grassroots leadership from over 20 First Nations across the country that have been engaged in battles in their local communities to defend their land and their rights and their way of life from outside threats, under the cloak of economic development.
And so let's talk a little bit about some of the people that are here at this particular gathering, Clayton. Where can we, it's across the country.
I guess that just to name a few, you know, there are so many and we have limited time, but a couple snapshots are, you know, we have representation from the Innu of Labrador, representation from the Maliseet of New Brunswick. We have representation here from KI and Ardoch Lake, two communities which have been in the media as a result of their resistance to the attempts of the of mining companies trying to illegally operate in their traditional territories without consulting the local leadership or the people. We have communities from here in Manitoba, including representation from the Michikamak Cree Nation, otherwise known as Cross Lake First Nation, that are here to talk about their ongoing struggle with the Crown and with the legacy of hydro development and its impacts on their way of life. Going west across this beautiful land, we have representatives here from Alberta that are fighting the largest industrial development ever known to man, known as the tar sands. We have representation from Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation, which is at the forefront of resistance against the tar sands development in Alberta. And we also have multiple representatives here from British Columbia, from First Nations that have been, you know, fighting everything from ski resorts that are encroaching upon their traditional territories to the emerging 2010 Winter Olympics, which are taking place, of course, in Vancouver, which have caused enormous amounts of displacement and impacts not only on the land and environment in the Vancouver and Lower Mainland area, but also social impacts in terms of displacement of the poor and of, you know, low-income families in Vancouver's urban metro that have been displaced as a result of skyrocketing, home costs because of the gentrification attached to the Olympic development, which has commonly been referred to as the corporate circus 2010, because of the fact that the Olympics very much is being used as a quick pass for uninhibited development in the city of Vancouver. So we've got an incredible amount of perspectives of community struggles that are represented by individuals that have attended this gathering. And I think even more so, we've also got a lot of non-Native solidarity supporters, allies, friends of these struggles that have been supporting these Native-led struggles across Canada that are also a part of the discussion over the next two days, and of course the discussion that we had today.
Well, it sounds like a wonderful mix of individuals who have come together to really get their message out. Now, I guess my next question would be the timing of this particular gathering. Was there a reason behind the specific timing of this, or was just a date picked ambiguously?
Well, you know, I think that there's a couple of things. You know, we definitely thought that Winnipeg, you know, just geographically is very close to the heart of what we as Indigenous peoples refer to as Turtle Island, what everyone else, I guess, on Mother Earth calls North America. So we thought that it would be good to meet in that heart of Turtle Island, to come together in a central place. But I guess strategically, you know, the Conservative Caucus, the Calvary, has descended upon Winnipeg for the Conservative Convention. And, of
yes.
course, Prime Minister Harper will be addressing the Conservative Caucus at Winnipeg's Convention Center tomorrow night.
That's correct.
At 7 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's their big party. And we wanted to make sure that, you know, while they're tooting their horns after this last federal election where there was absolutely no mention of the grave situation that Indigenous peoples in this country are facing, you know, that we give them a reminder that, hey, we're here, and, you know, we're here to demand our rights, and we will continue to organize, you know, from the bottom up to make sure that, you know, that we can achieve great systematic change. And so, you know, we will be delivering a letter to Mr. Harper and the Conservative Caucus that's meeting at the Convention Center, and we will be having a press conference on Friday, you know, issuing a statement about that's coming out of this conference in terms of a collective position. You know, it's interesting that this Harper government has $21 billion to throw at a war in Afghanistan. And yet it can't even you know, address issues, and it has no money to address the Kelowna Accord or any other plan to address the grave injustices that Native people are facing here in this country.
And I mean, you make an interesting point there in regards to the Kelowna Accord and some of the other issues you brought up. So at the end of this, I mean, we have a 3-day gathering here of activists from across the country. What are the goals that, I mean, we've talked about some of them, but at the end of this conference, what are we hoping to see happen?
Well, you know, I think that one of the things, there is a rich history of organizing, of Indigenous people stepping up and organizing structures to address, you know, the power struggle of the day. And I think that, you know, the purpose of this gathering is to come out of this with a clear set of directives coming from a broad swath of First Nation perspectives, of Indigenous perspectives, around some of the structural and systematic issues that we face that exacerbate the on-the-ground socioeconomic crisis that many of our communities still face to this day as a result of failed racist assimilative policies of days gone by. And one of the things that I guess as an emerging goal that is coming out of this first day is that we want to see the creation of a network, a Native-led network that can support our communities that in many times are organizing and resisting in isolation. And we want to see something that can be created that can provide that on-the-ground support to communities in struggle, and that can you know, represent you know, solutions that speak to the problems that we face during this time in our people's broad movement for the recognition of our rights as Indigenous peoples, of our ownership of our land and resources, and of the defense of our sacred home fires and traditions.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Clayton, for sharing all this information with us today. I'm sure it's, you know, something that people are aware of, but it's always good to keep that message coming out there so that we can rally people together to speak up to the government, to any present government that is ruling, whether it's Liberal, Conservative, Green, it doesn't matter. The whole idea is to address the issues for the First Nations and the Métis people of this country. So thank you so much. And good luck.
Thank you for having me.
And that was Clayton Thomas Mueller, who is the co-convener of the Defenders of the Land gathering taking place here at the Indian Métis and Friendship Center in the north end of Winnipeg.
This is Alert Radio for people who want to change the world. I'm Jeff Hughes, and I'm joined now by John Ryan, who is a retired professor of geography and a senior scholar at the University of Winnipeg. Welcome to Alert, John.
I'm very happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, we're most glad to have you with us. So, on a recent article posted on the Canadian Dimension website, you say, quote, a conservative majority would pose an unprecedented danger to our country, and only a liberal NDP-Green coalition could prevent this from happening. Explain why.
Well, almost two-thirds of Canada's voters in the last two elections oppose the policies and philosophy of the Conservatives, but it's the Conservatives who formed the government, and it's because the majority vote was split amongst four parties. And this makes a mockery of democracy. And if this continues, this is exactly what's going to continue into the future. We'll have a series of conservative governments. And if Duceppe should retire and the Conservatives get a greater hold in Quebec, we'll wind up with a majority government. And that's worrisome. So my resolution to this is that the Liberals, the NDP, and the Greens should form a coalition. And usually coalitions are formed after an election. But because of this state of affairs in Canada, I'm advocating that the coalition be formed before the next election. Because after the next election, the Conservatives may have a majority, and it's too late for coalitions. In any event, that's the essence of my proposal.
And can you tell us how this coalition would work? I've seen some numbers that are very convincing, but can you explain to our listeners how this would look?
Well, what I did, I made a careful analysis of the Elections Canada data on the last election, and I discovered that there are 59 constituencies in this last election where the combined Liberal NDP Green vote exceeded the Conservatives, or the Bloc vote. And if you formed a coalition, out of these 59 seats, the Liberals could gain 48 of them, the NDP 9, and the Greens 2 seats. And if you... My proposal is that they should run all incumbent candidates. You know, all the ones who were elected, they should be unopposed in the next election. And wherever you have Conservative or Bloc candidates, you should run one candidate from the party that had the largest vote in the 2008 election. And in that way, it's possible that the Liberals could gain as many as 125 seats in a coalition, the NDP 46, the Greens 2, the Conservatives would be reduced to 92, and the Bloc to 41. And in such a situation, I would see that the cabinet could be composed of 72% Liberals, 27% NDP, and 1% from the Green Party. So in any event, that is my that is essentially my proposal. That's for the election strategy.
So any MPs currently sitting for the Liberals or the NDP would not face a challenge from their coalition partners?
Exactly. That's correct.
Okay. Now, what about the charge, though? Let's look at this a little more closely. What about the charge that the Liberals, federal Liberals, campaign from the left and then govern from the right?
Well, the point is...
Well,
point
hang here. On a second, John, because I just wanted to support that by referencing the fact that public opinion polling shows that the second choice for most Liberal voters is, in fact, the Conservative Party. So when, from an electoral viewpoint, it gets better results for competing for the center, what would motivate the Liberals to join this coalition?
Well, this is going to be a problem. There's going to be a problem on the part of the Greens, the part of the NDP and the Liberals. The point is that in a coalition, the three parties would retain their individual identities, I'm not advocating a merger of the parties into one party. That's what the right wing did when they swallowed up the progressive conservatives. All they would have to do is agree to an electoral strategy, an election strategy, and agree in a few fundamental issues. For the NDP, critically important that proportional representation be an issue, which if they form a coalition government, this would be enacted. You know, they could easily agree on a child care program, a policy for First Nations people. If they had any guts, they should abrogate NAFTA, you know, things like this. Now, the issue about the Liberals campaigning from the left and governing from the campaigning from the left and governing from the right, if you have agreement on these issues, they have no choice but to follow through if they want to be part of the coalition. It's done in Europe and constantly where they agree on a few issues, and then they have to proceed with it. And if they don't, the coalition falls apart and the government falls apart.
Well, John, other than a few issues like protecting the CBC and the Canadian Wheat Board,
right.
What do these parties have in common? I mean, we've heard talk of a national child care plan before that never materialized.
Well, it just about did, and the NDP pulled the plug on it in 2006.
Well, what about the Liberals' terrible record on NAFTA? You mentioned we haven't. I don't know if we can turn to them for progressive policies on free trade. And of course, there's the attack on public health care, which began with Chrétien and Martin.
I realize that full well. In fact, the NDP itself does not have a policy in NAFTA, which I think is deplorable. But the thing is, if the Liberals ever want to get back into government, they would have to go through a coalition. I cannot see this happening again. It could be a minority government the next time around, but in all likelihood, it'll be a conservative government. So all these, the NDP and the Liberals, for all intents and purposes, need one another if they're going to get into government. It's the necessity of the thing that's going to drive them. I have a feeling that perhaps some of the right wing of the Liberal Party may join the conservatives. Well, very well and to the good. I think the Liberals need some ethnic cleansing.
Okay.
Let the right wing go and join the conservatives. And the other part, the remainder of the Liberal Party, if they get together with the NDP, even though some of the Liberals would have gone to the conservatives, with this proposal, the Liberals would get 125 seats and the conservatives would get 92. So that doesn't worry me that the Liberals might split. But to convince them, who the heck knows? We don't know. And there are people in the NDP who want to retain their purity and hope someday to replace the Liberals. The thing is, we don't have the luxury of time to do that. If the Liberals and the NDP keep fighting, it absolutely guarantees a further split vote, wouldn't you say?
Well, it seems to have panned out that way in the last two elections.
Exactly. And the prospects for the future are the same unless they form a coalition. Actually, I've discussed this with Ed Schreier, Howard Pauley, Alan Blakeney, Lloyd Axworthy. All of them agree that it is necessary to form a coalition, but they're not in total agreement on how this should be done. But they are in agreement that a coalition, some kind of, we cannot carry on with business as usual politics.
Well, you mentioned proportional representation as one of the first priorities of a coalition government.
Right.
Why not organize a campaign for that now?
How would you adopt it?
Well,
you'll never adopt it unless through a coalition government. The conservatives won't adopt it. The liberals won't adopt it on their own. And you're going to wait for the NDP to get a majority? Good luck. You could do it through a coalition. And that would be the price of the NDP. You want us to join a coalition? Fine. When we form a government, we will have to enact proportional representation. I think with good faith negotiations, maybe that could be done. I think that's the only way. And then afterwards, once we get proportional representation, if the NDP want to withdraw from the coalition, they can do so. In fact, they could even shift further to the right then, or to the left, because if they do that, they wouldn't have to worry about first past the post. They would get their proportionate share of members in the parliament once they have it. The critical thing is, how do you get proportional representation? And I think you could do it through a coalition.
How likely are the Liberals to be interested in this kind of a deal?
Well, as I say, if they, What do you think their prospects are in the next election, the way things are going?
Well, some of the commentators on Alert have suggested recently it's a crossroads for the Federal Liberal Party, although they haven't necessarily said that. This is the first I've heard of a coalition. There has been a lot of call for proportional representation. But
I know, and it's all that's all useless chatter, because you can never enact it unless you get a coalition to do it, to be blunt about it. And, you know, my worry is that the Liberals, left to themselves, may go further to the right as they're being urged. You know, we get away from the middle and they've gone too far to the left. Go further to the right. My God, we'll wind up with the American system where you have essentially the same party with two wings of the same party. Who the heck needs that?
Well, we certainly appreciate the clarity and the passion of your views, John. So thank you very much. For any final thoughts you'd like to add before we wrap this up?
Yes, I think people should urge the Liberals and the NDP and the Greens to form a coalition, unless there's support from the grassroots. Jim Laxer has said this. He's in total agreement with me, but he says unless there's support from the grassroots, it's not going to happen, unless it comes from their own members. So my advice is, for heaven's sakes, get through to them. I will be sending my proposal to all the Liberal and NDP members of Parliament in the next few days with a covering letter. And then we'll see what happens.
Well, John Ryan, thank you very much for your views, and we will certainly be paying close attention to the future of all of the political parties in the federal landscape.
Well, thank you so much for letting me do this.
I appreciate you joining us at Alert.
We all know about the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. Not too many of us, though, know about the war in the Congo. Yet this is the scene of the world's bloodiest conflict since World War II, with 5.4 million killed in the last decade. Now, 45,000 Congolese continue to die every month from both the conflict and humanitarian crisis. This does not say anything about the displacement of countless civilians forced to flee and the particularly vicious violence against women during the conflict. We have on the phone in Seattle, Washington, Aditya Ganapathiraju. He's a senior student at the University of Washington in Seattle, and he also writes for the school newspaper. So first off, let's talk about what is happening right there at this point in time, and why is the world taking notice?
Well, recently, fighting escalated in October when rebel forces fighting the Democratic Republic of Congo government forces. The rebel forces, led by General Makunda, took a famous national park in the eastern Congo, the province of Northern Kivu. And basically, it's been discovered that the province that they took is also incidentally high in abundant in natural resources. There's been a tenuous ceasefire, but the fighting continues, and as you mentioned, there's been quite a humanitarian crisis. Some 200,000 people have been displaced to the south, towards the capital of Goma.
Let's talk about what they're after exactly.
Basically, the natural resources is what rebel forces are thought to be after. The park is full of natural resources, and by natural resources, I'm speaking specifically of things like copper, cobalt, coltan. Coltan, for example, the Congo has 80% of the world's supply, and it's used in all of our phones, our laptops, you know, PlayStations, although Sony, I don't think, use Congolese coltan, but most of our electronics use this material, and so it's very sought after by Western businesses.
Let's go back a little bit into the history of the Congo. Now, you know, some people are probably familiar with the Congo and where it is in Africa, but they're probably not familiar with the history, Aditya. So give us a brief history of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, if you don't mind.
Sure. Well, we'll go back towards when the Congo was under the colonial occupation of Belgium and King Leopold II. Under him, there was quite a vicious rule, to be honest, and he, according to some, turned it into a virtual slave colony for exporting rubber, which was, you know, the coltan and copper of that day. The Congo gained its independence in 1960, June, and Patrice Lumumba was their first democratically elected leader. This sent panic through many Western countries, especially the United States, and so there were plans, and plans actually hatched at the CIA and the White House to overthrow him, and with the help of the CIA, Lumumba was assassinated. This all came out during a 1975 Church Committee hearings at the U.S. Congress. So after that, there was a few decades of violence under Mobutu, a dictator that was supported by the West, by the U.S. in particular. And after the Rwandan genocide, which most of your listeners are probably familiar with, the official story is Rwanda invaded the provinces of the DRC in 1996 to chase after Hutu genocidaries who fled Rwanda. But really, the UN found out in a panel that they convened, and they sent statesmen to the DRC. They found out that Rwanda actually went in to the areas with the natural resources first.
Right.
They even cooperated with many of the genocidaries, the Hutu perpetrators of the genocide. And so it kind of, that actually led to six other nations joining in, and it happened again in 98. So it's really, kind of a pillage of the unfortunate fact that these people, the Congolese, are living on a land full of natural resources.
Of course. And obviously, again, as we had talked about earlier, a lot of these other countries surrounding them want a piece of the action. And so when we know it's quite complicated and difficult to follow for those of us unfamiliar, of course, with the history and the main players. Now, among them, of course, are the forces themselves in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, but also the surrounding countries, as you mentioned, Rwanda, the States, the United Nations, and quite recently, China. Now, you talked a little earlier about some of the resources. Are all of these countries after the same thing then? What are they all after, and what are their specific and prospective roles, Adacha?
So that's basically what I concluded just from my tiny amount of research, that the UN did a report in 2001 and 2003, and they found over 100 different businesses involved from all across the world, from China to Belgium, the U.S., several in the U.S., several in Canada, all across the world who were who formed what the U.N. called an army of businesses, unquote. And they were involved in the illegal exploitation of Congolese minerals, like diamonds, gold, coltan, like I mentioned.
Right.
Their prospective roles, I mean, it's in the interest of these different businesses to have the rebel forces, and they're buying most of I've heard some reports that they're buying these minerals from the rebel forces who are occupying the areas, like this most recent takeover of that national park.
And let's talk a little bit about Canada.
Well, the 2003 report named, I see seven corporations here. Also, Maurice Carney from the Friends of the Congo, he's the executive director of the Friends of the Congo, an advocacy group in Washington, D.C., has stated that almost every Canadian prime minister since Pierre Trudeau has been involved in the mining company of the Congo. I can't, confirm that myself, but this is what Mr. Carney said.
And the reports are saying. And right. How are they, are they practicing ethical standards, or are they not, along with the other countries that we've talked about?
Well, I wouldn't say it's the countries directly, like the governments are, giving out orders. It's more, probably more like a business venture in terms of what these different businesses are doing. And I don't think they are acting ethically. You know, one of the quotes from the UN report is that this was the illegal exploitation of the Congo.
Okay.
Those were its words. And, you know, you can look it up on Google, the UN report on Congo.
Of course.
And you can read it, and it's really quite shocking.
I'm going to end off by, what is the way out of this particular horror, would you say? I mean, the 17,000 United Nations troops have obviously failed to quell this particular violence at this present time. So what's your answer?
Well, I'm afraid I'm not so knowledgeable as to prescribe an answer, but I'll give you one that that many commentators are giving. You know, you mentioned the violence against the women, and it's probably the worst in the world, you know, according to the UN and Congolese activists who are speaking out, especially the rapes. But as one activist said, the rapes is a war against the women, and the source of the rapes is the conflict, and ultimately the source of the conflict is the scramble for the Congo's wealth. So in order to stop the rapes and the conflict, you really need to stop the exploitation, and one can't talk about the conflict in a vacuum as if it wasn't being fueled by, you know, the West buying these blood-soaked minerals.
Well, thank you so much for your time today on this, Aditya. Much appreciated.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And that was Aditya Ganapathiraju, who is a student in Seattle, Washington. And we heard from him today on the disastrous situation in the Congo.
You're listening to Music is the Weapon. I'm André Clément. Not to be confused with Alert Radio's technical producer, Tommy Allen, Tony Allen is a Nigerian-born drummer, composer, and songwriter. He is widely regarded as the co-founder of Afrobeat Music. Music is the Weapon listeners may recall a profile we did on Tony Allen's partner in crime, Fela Kuti, back in September. While Fela was always the star in their collaboration, Fela always maintained that, was it not for Tony Allen, there would be no Afrobeat. Let's listen to what Fela was talking about. This is Don't Fight Your Wars by Tony Allen.
We don't need your wars, man. You, the world leaders, get yourself together, man. Stop all those fights around the world. Political, religious.
Tony Allen recorded over 30 albums with Fela Kuti and the Africa 70. He was also the musical director of the band. But amid growing dissension in the ranks of the Africa 70 in the late 1970s, Tony Allen would seek a new and original sound for himself in Europe. He would eventually marry and settle in Paris, where he began to collaborate with a cross-section of artists deconstructing and fusing Afrobeat with electronica, dub, R&B, and rap. Here is an R&B infused number for you. This one is entitled Calling.
I'm
Africanism, social activism, and calling out the elite have always been artistic priorities for Tony Allen. But he also has a playful side. Here's a song that is a tribute to his wife's cooking. This is Home Cooking.
Cooking is the best, my friend. Cause once you've had it, you won't be hungry again. Cause it will nourish you deep within your soul. You won't be eating junk food no more. Cause this kind of food was prepared long ago by our ancestors way back home. Stirred rhythm brew just for your palate. So when you chop it, you know that you've had it. That's why we give thanks before we eat. To praise the Lord for each tasty beat. So women know your craft, men know your women. Cause the secret's all in home cooking. That's really what it's all about. So tell me, will ya dish it out?
Listening to Music is the Weapon. I'm André Clément.
Well, that's our program for this week. Thanks, as usual, to all the people that helped make Alert happen. Nash Soonwala for the headlines.
Karen McIntosh for Around the Left in 7 Days.
Technical producer Tommy Allen.
And our executive producer, Cy Gonick.
André Clément for Music is the Weapon.
And of course you, Jeffrey Hughes, my co-host.
Oh, thanks, Chrissy, and our gratitude to you as well. Alert Radio is broadcast on the Canadian Dimension National Radio Network.
And if you'd like to hear today's episode, just go to rabble.ca. If you'd like to hear today's and previous episodes, please go to www.canadiandimension.com. Thanks so much, and we'll see you next week.
Bye-bye.